Hello, and welcome to the American Chronicle, a podcast dedicated to a consideration of the latest political machinations in the United States, along with a look at the latest cultural offerings from across the pond. This week, we will be discussing the State of the Union, presidential nominations, and asking if it's time for Bruce Willis to hang up his diehard vest. Without further ado, here is the host of the American Chronicle, the Senior Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London, Dr. James D. Boyes. So, Dr. Boyes, what was the key event in Washington this week?
This week in Washington, D.C., we saw the State of the Union, which was Barack Obama's real attempt to try and talk to the American people over the heads of Congress in an attempt to try to convince the American people and voters of the righteousness of his course of action. This, of course, was an opportunity to speak directly to 50 million Americans on television over the heads of Congress in a chamber which included the Supreme Court members as well as various invited dignitaries from around the country. It really is the equivalent of the budget here in the United Kingdom, and an opportunity for the President to lay out his agenda for the coming 12 months and to see how he views the direction of the United States at the beginning of his second term in office.
Now, you've mentioned that it's like the budget in Britain, but what is the political significance of the State of the Union?
The State of the Union address very much has evolved with the nation. If we think about how it was that this was originally presented, the Constitution merely says that the President needs to report from time to time upon the State of the Union. And for the first 150 years of the presidency, this was delivered in a written report. In around the 1913 era, presidents began reporting directly to Congress in a speech. But even until the 1960s, this was done in the afternoon and with no consideration for primetime television audiences. That has completely changed. And now the primetime State of the Union is very much a symbol of the imperial presidency. The idea of a very high note address by the president, received by his supporters well in Capitol Hill, opposed roundly by his opponents. This is really almost political pantomime, if you will. And as a result of which, there is a degree to which there is an awful lot of high stakes and low politics at play here. And you see the president outlining his agenda, and with a view to then taking it on the road. You've seen President Obama leave Washington immediately after the address to take his case to the American people, to tour various key battleground states, and to try to deliver upon his continuing efforts to change the United States in his image.
And more specifically, what was the president's message?
What you saw from the president was an attempt to try to deliver a smorgasbord, I think, of ideas for his supporters to rally behind. We saw efforts to withdraw forces from Afghanistan, for example. We've seen efforts to discuss gun control legislation. We saw issues with regard to immigration reform. These are not new issues. These are issues that were on the table a year ago. There's talk about immigration reform, and we've seen in recent weeks a bipartisan group emerge out of Congress, from the Senate in particular, looking to address this, led by people like Senator John McCain, Senator Rubio, Senator Schumer, for example. The president's got his own ideas about how he should go about doing this. It seems that it would be an awful lot better if he just got behind a united Senate approach and could throw the White House support behind that. This being America and this being politics, of course, everybody wants to lay claim for any successes. So we'll see what comes from this. Tying the two together, Afghanistan, gun control, and immigration. We've seen the growing rise of drones, for example, and this week it's emerged that there is a request to start using drone technology over the United States' own airspace. So one wonders how long it will be before drones are being used to patrol, particularly the southern borders, in an attempt to try to crack down on immigration.
You mentioned some bipartisan attempts already. How likely is it that any of Obama's proposals are going to pass?
What was fascinating about the State of the Union address was the wide-ranging agenda that the president unveiled for the start of his second term. Now, one could argue that at the beginning of a new four-year term in office, this is quite appropriate. But one needs to recognize a salient fact here, which is that President Obama will not be running for re-election in 2016. Indeed, 2 years from now, a third of the United States Senate and all of the House of Representatives will have been re-elected in the midterm elections of 2014. And after that date on the calendar, all eyes will be turning to the presidential election of 2016, at which Barack Obama is term limited and prohibited from running. As a result of this, therefore, one needs to think about who it is that will be running for the Democratic nomination in 2016. This is important because once those midterm elections are out of the way, a great deal of Barack Obama's legislative power, authority, will start to wane. He will be a lame duck president. And so as a result of this, he really has 18 months to try to get anything done, because after that, the last 6 months of that first 2 years will be focused upon the midterm elections. And after that, all eyes will be upon the presidential election of 2016. So within 18 months, Barack Obama is proposing a great deal, addressing immigration reform, handgun control legislation, and withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. The latter is a little easier for him to dwell upon because as commander of chief, he can do that. When it comes to gun control legislation, if he doesn't move quickly on this, he realizes, I think, that the opportunities are going to dwindle very, very quickly. In fact, I think that, quite frankly, most legislation he introduces will be dead on arrival. And immigration reform has some chance of moving forward, but I would really encourage the president, instead of trying to play his own game on this, to try and get behind emerging bipartisan support for this issue on Congress, to team up with John McCain and with Chuck Schumer out of New York, and to try to throw his weight behind his Senate bill on this, rather than try to initiate any moves from the White House.
Well, Dr. Boies, thank you very much for that analysis of the State of the Union. What other events have been important in Washington this week?
In addition to the State of the Union, Washington has been abuzz this week with congressional nomination hearings. This, of course, is an opportunity for the United States Senate to grill the president's nominees for the cabinet. The United States Constitution gives the United States Senate oversight over presidential nominations. And in this case, we've been looking at the hearings to this position of Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and Director of Central Intelligence. With regard to this, we have Senator John Kerry, we have Chuck Hagel and John Brennan been nominated for the three respective posts. And all three, it seems, are receiving a very, very different and very telling reception from senators on Capitol Hill.
Now, why did Senator Kerry sail through his nomination?
It's important to remember, of course, that Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts was not the president's first choice to replace Hillary Clinton at the State Department. That honor fell to Dr. Susan Rice, the administration's ambassador to the United Nations in its first term. You will no doubt recall, of course, that this nomination process fell upon barren ground in recent months, when it was very, very clear, following a series of meetings, that key senators were not going to endorse Dr. Rice to be Secretary of State, following a series of appearances on all five Sunday morning chat shows in the United States, in which she made reference to the Benghazi attacks, which killed Senator Stevens, as being some sort of a spontaneous uprising. So, having killed at birth, effectively, the president's first choice to be Secretary of State, whoever came to replace him was probably certainly going to get a slightly easier ride. The fact that he nominated John Kerry is telling for many reasons. It's important to note, of course, that Senator Obama, as he was, came to national prominence in 2004, having been invited to give the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention that nominated Senator Kerry for the presidency. So there's a degree to which Obama was indebted to Senator Kerry. Following Kerry's defeat in 2004 to George W. Bush, he returned to the Senate and was named chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he served with distinction over the last couple of years, and has become seen almost as a natural selection to become a potential Secretary of State in a Democratic administration. He was a member of the Old Boys Network, effectively, in the Senate, and got on very well with his fellow members, played the game, effectively, and effectively the wax was on the tracks as he appeared before his colleagues in the United States Senate, where he certainly received a warm and welcome reception and became a natural, I think, shoo-in to become Secretary of State. And as a result of this, he's now going to be filling Hillary Clinton's shoes as Secretary of State in Barack Obama's second term, where he has an awful lot to deal with, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the ongoing repercussions from the Arab Spring, issues in Syria, foreign relations including Iraq and Israel, where of course he'll have to prepare for the President's forthcoming visit this spring. So a very full inbox for the new Secretary of State, and one must wish him well in his endeavours.
And what will be the fate of Hegel?
Just as John Kerry received a relatively easy ride from his former colleagues in the United States Senate, the same cannot be true of Chuck Hagel, the President's nominee to become Secretary of Defense and fill Leon Panetta's shoes at the Pentagon. Chuck Hagel was not seen to be a member of the old boys network in the Senate and was somewhat seen as an outsider in that chamber, even by his fellow Republicans. He has not assisted himself, perhaps, during the nomination process in some of the statements he's come out with, some of the revelations with regard to his views upon the role of Israel in the United States, some of the organizations he's been suggested to have been involved with. And at this point, one must wonder whether he will actually be nominated. On a simple basis of numerical breakdowns in the United States Senate, the Democrats do hold the majority, so they should be able to withstand any attempts to filibuster any moves on the part of the Republicans. However, it must be noted that it was on the cards that Hagel would have been confirmed this week, and the Republicans have managed to delay that, pushing it into next week. So I dare say we'll be talking at this time next week about the position with regard to Chuck Hagel and whether he has or has not been confirmed as Secretary of Defense for the second term. On a final note on the position with regard to the Secretary of Defense, I think one must sympathize with any defense-minded Democrats in the United States Senate or across the United States. Now, for the second administration on a row following the Clinton administration in its second term, when faced with an opportunity to name a defense secretary, both Obama and Bill Clinton have now plunged for Republicans. I'm all for bipartisanship, but I think if you're a defense-minded Democrat, it's very, very telling that both in 1996 and now in 2012, when faced with an opportunity to name a Democrat to the position and head the Defense Department, both Clinton and Obama have gone for Republicans.
And next week, will we still be talking about John Brennan?
John Brennan is a name which I imagine most people are not particularly as au fait with as they are with, say, Senator Kerry. 4 years ago, he was Barack Obama's first choice to be DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, and was forced to withdraw his name from consideration once it became apparent that he was quite closely linked with and supportive of the Bush administration's enhanced interrogation techniques, which would include waterboarding, of course. After 4 years as being President Obama's behind-the-scenes guy in the White House, advising the president on anti-terrorism practices, including the kill-or-capture concepts, and advocating enhanced use of drone technology, one wonders about the wisdom of this, to be quite honest. The President of the United States is surrounded by a relatively small number of key advisors on any one issue, and Brennan has certainly emerged over the last 4 years as a key advisor on foreign affairs and anti-terrorism concepts. By moving him out of the White House and placing him all the way over in Virginia, one wonders whether the President is actually denying himself the input of a key and trusted advisor. One could argue, well, he'll now be head of the CIA. Well, that's fine, but the role of the CIA director involves an awful lot more than just briefing the president, and involves an awful lot of management skills, which one wonders whether John Brennan is in possession of. Brennan's nomination has raised more questions from Democrats, concerns about his muscular use of drone technology and enhanced interrogation techniques, and raised very few questions from the Republicans. The exact opposite, arguably, of what you've seen with Chuck Hagel, I think, whose nomination has been opposed by the Republicans and embraced more roundly, perhaps, by the Democratic Party. So certainly I think Barack Obama has given himself some cause for thought and perhaps caused himself some headaches with regard to the nomination process, which he could well have avoided with a little bit more forethought.
Thank you, Dr. Boyes, for that insightful political roundup of the week. I understand we've also crossed some important cultural thresholds.
This week has seen the release of the fifth Die Hard movie, not being referred to as Die Hard 5, but the correct title of A Good Day to Die Hard. Those of us who can remember the release of the first film in this series back in 1988 will remember what a tremendous event that was, and a surprise hit at the box office. Before this, Bruce Willis was known to many of us as the star of Moonlighting, but his first two theatrical outings, the rather awful Blind Date and the instantly forgettable Sunset, had failed to set the world alight. So when he suddenly received $5 million, which was an astronomical fee back then for his role as John McClane in Die Hard, this was reason to sit up on itself. Coupling Bruce Willis together with the wonderful direction of John McTiernan produced a mightily successful film, which went on to spawn a whole franchise, as well as a number of imitation movies. If you think of Speed, what was it? Die Hard on a Bus. If you think of Under Siege, what was it? Die Hard on a Battleship. And indeed, this idea, this concept of setting Die Hard in a new setting, very much became a concept at a whole series of development meetings held in Hollywood in the late 1980s. Unfortunately, it seems that Die Hard has run out of a place to set Die Hard movies. If one thinks about how the franchise has developed, with the first one being based in a building, the second one based in an airport, the third one, Die Hard with a Vengeance, based in a city, New York, a fourth based in a metropolitan area, maybe Washington, D.C., and to some extent the northeastern seaboard of the United States, and the fifth now based upon and around the entire nation of Russia. Quite clearly, John McClane's capacities are now having to fill entire nations. One wonders how long it is before he has to travel into space in his next installments, although, of course, we've already seen Bruce Willis do that in Armageddon. The great problem with this, of course, is that what made the first Die Hard such a great movie, that claustrophobic sense of an enclosed space, the idea that this was just a normal guy in an extraordinary circumstances who bled when he was cut and who feared for his own survival, has completely disappeared. Over the successive numbers of films, we've seen Bruce Willis's character become more and more superhero-like, to a point whereby one wonders, you know, why even bother, you know, trying to prevent John McClane from succeeding when apparently failure is not an option. The humanity has left the character, and the character has changed beyond all recognition. The people involved in the production have changed beyond all recognition. We've gone from having key directors such as John McTiernan and Remy Harlin to relatively unknown and unimpressive directors. This is a franchise which really has run out of steam and is suffering from a complete lack of love, care and attention. And really, it's time, I think, now for Bruce Willis to admit defeat, something his character, John McClane, of course, could never do.
There is, of course, another franchise that is still going very strong, is there not?
Well, this is true. And again, it's interesting to note that some 50 years after the release of the first film in the franchise, the latest James Bond film makes its way onto the small screen this week. Skyfall, which has become the most successful Bond film of all time, taking in over $1 billion, making it one of the top films ever made, actually. It's being purported as being the most successful British film ever made, although I'm not entirely sure what's British about it these days. A wonderful release in an ongoing franchise, which in complete contrast to the Die Hard franchise, the Jack Ryan franchise, shows what you can do with a character when you surround it with key talented people, with the love, care and attention that these projects require, and nurture projects and not just see them as complete cash cows to be exploited as and when possible. If you look at the James Bond franchise based upon the original books by Fleming, these films have gone from strength to strength to strength through tough times and times of adversity, times when they were seen to be unfashionable. They've been off the air for a number of years throughout the 50 years that they've been ongoing, but they keep coming back stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think that if you look at the central dynamics of the character, what he's about, what he aims to achieve, the way he goes about doing it, it is proof, I think, that you can have an ongoing franchise with recurring characters that are beloved around the world without descending into some sort of self-parody, as long as you have a central character that one cares about, trusts in, believes in, and wants to see more and more regularly. So I, for one, will be looking forward to Daniel Craig's next outing, because don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, James Bond will return.
Thank you very much, Dr. James Dubois, for your interesting and insightful comments. We'll look forward next week to your instalment of The American Chronicle.